Welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Killip. Today we're picking things up with part two of The Triumph of Life, in which Rabbi Yitz Greenberg is joined by Rabbi Aaron Alexander of Addis Israel Congregation in Washington, D.C. Together they look at concrete ways that the Torah translates the value of life into practice through laws and mitzvot. Let's listen in.
Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We are particularly excited to bring you this series in partnership with Addis and with the support of the Federation of Greater Washington. We're going to have about 30 minutes of Rav Yitz laying out some ideas for us, and then we'll have about 20 minutes back and forth conversation between Rabbi Aaron Alexander and Rav Yitz. And then at the end, there'll be about 20 minutes question and answer for you to share some questions in the chat that Rabbi Aaron and that Rav Yitz can respond to. Rav Yitz.
The central theme that Judaism as a religion is a religion. Its main message is life, for life. And last week, we talked about the living God, the God, the source of life, who loves life and recruits humans to join in partnership for tikkun olam, for, if you will, world repair. But what's the definition of world repair? To fill the world with life, especially life being treated with the dignity and respect that it deserves, and especially the highest, most developed form of life thus far, human being, which is life so developed, so godlike, that it's called the image of God in the Torah, and therefore is born with or endowed with the dignities of infinite value, beyond money, equality, and uniqueness. And finally, the theme last week, that we are called humans, all humans, but Judaism as makes it a central part of its own covenant. And if Rabbi Alexander is pushing social action, here is the fulfillment to repair the world to the point where overcome the enemies of life, whether they are poverty and hunger, whether they're discrimination, oppression, racism, or whether they be even war or sickness, all the enemies of life, so that in the end, the world and everyday behavior, this is the central Jewish vision, that in central everyday treatment of people, both in nature and in society, they'll be treated like creatures of infinite value, equality, uniqueness. This week, what I'd like to do is explore another application of the thesis, which very simply is that Judaism teaches the supremacy of life. It's the priority commitment of people. It should be the priority of people. It is the priority commitment of the religion. And I want to explore it in three ways, very simply. One, the commitment to increase the quantity of life. Speaking now, I will be focusing this session on human life. To increase the quantity of life in the world, otherwise known as the mitzvah pru revu, to be fruitful and multiply. Secondly, the commitment to increase the quality of life in the universe, in the world, particularly to improve each individual human being to become an image of God, not just in terms of dignity, but in terms of capacity to become more capable, more godlike in every individual. And the third, of course, when I say these are priorities or commitments, they're going to take all human commitment, all of your life, as you will, to achieve this. And last but not least, when there is a clash between life and religious and other commitments, life comes first, life overrides. It's called pikuach nefesh in Hebrew, saving a life. But as I'll try to show, it implies the issue that the Torah, that all commandment, that all religion is about enhancing life, not about obedience to God or any other value system. So to start from the beginning, our commitment to fill the world with life or to ensure that life goes on even after us. I speak of the mitzvah pru revu, which if you look at the Torah, it's literally the first commandment in the Torah. And that commandment is in fact addressed to humanity, not just to the Jewish people. So this commitment to have children, if you will. Now, the obvious question is, what do you mean by having children as a mitzvah? Having children is a natural process. All animals, all creatures have children It's the so-called selfish gene, ensuring the survival of the species by maximizing the creation of life. So why is this a mitzvah? I mean, the Torah doesn't say that breathing is a mitzvah or urination or defecation, the processes of living, they're not called a mitzvah, they're just a natural process. So why is having children a mitzvah? And I think the answer is that Judaism wants people, wants human beings, to take responsibility for the chain of life. We are here, humans are here, because of the evolution of life from one-celled forms of life to now the most developed form, the image of God, the human being. Had at any point along the way, a failure to assure, to create the next generation, the chain of life would have ended. And in fact, we know there are species, either other species of human beings that literally failed and were wiped out. So the Torah says that each individual now should feel responsible, as this is not just doing what comes naturally. This is a conscious choice. You should see yourself as a responsible member of the chain of life, responsible to assure that it does not end with me. And that's why I have children. If I don't have children, and this can bring up in the questions and answers, if I can't have children, the answer is I can enable others, or I can preserve and protect and develop other life. But in principle, I am responsible for the continuity of life itself. And then the Gemara tries to explore. This is, of course, a rather unique commandment or mitzvah, if you think about it. I mean, Shabbat is an incredible mitzvah. It takes one day out of seven. Or Yom Kippur, again, tremendously demanding commitment, commandment, but it's one day out of 365 days. Eating kosher, it's every day in the year, but it's a few minutes a day. Here, this commandment, this mitzvah of having children, assuring the chain of life, this mitzvah is 24/7 for the rest of your life. That's how bad it is. This mitzvah is 24/7 for the rest of your life. In fact, it is at the one time the greatest occupation, takes up more time and more commitment and more effort, more emotional capacity. It is the greatest source of pleasure and fulfillment when it works. And I should say, it's also the greatest source of aggravation when there are problems of suffering, and God forbid, even of devastating loss. So it is an incredible commandment and responsibility to try to take this on. Now that the Gemara asks the simple question, what's the minimum fulfillment? If this is a commandment, how can I fulfill it? What's the minimum commitment? And the answer is, and this is the text, which I'm not going to read now, but it's before you. It is a machloket, a disagreement between rabbis, but in essence, Ben Hillel concludes that it's having two children, one male and one female, although in the end, the Gemara concludes that if you have two males or two females, you fulfilled it because somebody else will have the polar opposite and will have the ability to keep life going. So in essence, two children is the fulfillment of this all-encompassing and remarkable mitzvah. But hold on, says the Gemara. What does it mean? Well, of course it means is that if I leave behind two children, that means that we are leaving behind no less life in the world than we, the parents, represent. Two parents leave behind two children. But the Gemara says, if you look at Isaiah chapter 45, verse 18, Isaiah chapter 45, verse at the end of this text, it says, Lo tohu ro, the world was not created to be waste or void, it was formed to be inhabited, from which the Talmud concludes that we are responsible to make sure that the earth is populated and life does not disintegrate or disappear. So the Talmud then says, even though you've already had two children, you continue because you want to fulfill the commandment. We're committed not just to have two children, which means that when we die, there will be a draw, as it were, between life and death. There'll be no less life in the world, but no more. So the third child, the child that you have after fulfilling the mitzvah, becomes the fulfillment of the calling of human beings to fill the earth with life. And now I add another passage, which I don't know if we have before you. No, this passage, we did not get ready in time, but I'll read it. I'll read a section of it to you. The Talmud then goes into a kind of a side comment that reflects the deeper issue. The Talmud then says, there's a verse in Ecclesiastes, in the morning sow your seed, and in the afternoon, if you will, in the latter part of life, do not hold back, for you do not know which of the harvests will succeed, or if both of them as one. This commandment or this instruction, it means if you had a family when you were young and lost it, have a family in your old age. And then the Talmud goes on to say, if you studied Torah in your childhood, then study again a second time, do it again as well in later life. And finally, if you had family or children in younger days, then have again in later life. And the Talmud then tells the following story. Rabbi Akiva, the greatest teacher of his time, he had 24,000 students, 12,000 pairs of students, and they were all wiped out in one period. There's a tradition that says it was a plague. There's a tradition that says it was the Roman wars in which the Romans persecuted the rabbis. In any event, he lost all the student, the incredible student following he had built up in a lifetime. At the age of 80, says the Talmud, what did he do? The world was wiped out. The answer is he went to the Rabbosenu Shabbadarom. He went to the southern part of Israel, and he found students and started again at the age of 80 with individual students. And who are they? They mentioned some people like Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elezer ben Shamua. But in fact, these are, in fact, if we look carefully, these are the people who are the main rabbis of the Mishnah. In other words, because of death might have wiped out his legacy, starting again and having it in old age when most people alone since have not created, not achieved, also becomes a guarantee that life will be stronger than death. From which I take it that the Gemara is hinting at with children too. If you want to have that third child to assure the what you leave behind more life, there is also the risk of destruction and losing of a child. And therefore, La'erev, this commandment to assure life by having it again and creating it again, by teaching Torah again, is fulfilled with yet another child. So the bottom line, as I say, is that this commandment is not a responsibility for life, but it gives us the commandment and the commitment to not be satisfied with balancing the forces of death, but rather to create more life so that my life leaves behind more life than before I came into this world. Which brings me to the second major theme of the primacy of life, and it's the question of the quality of life and improving the quality of life. I refer you here, and there's a text which I will not have time to go through entirely, a text by Rabbi Soloveitchik called Shlichut, Messenger or Mission. It's a reflection on human beings, on their dignities, and on their calling in life. To make a long story short, Soloveitchik suggests that the God has made human beings in the image of God, and human beings in the image of God have such dignity that the whole Torah, actually, all the commandments between human beings are built on this fact that it's an image of God, therefore you must treat them properly. Since they have infinite value, equality, uniqueness, as I said last week, that means you can't cheat on them, you can't hurt them, you're supposed to honor them. I won't go through all this detail now. But continuing, Soloveitchik comes up with a very interesting original thing. Human beings are in the image of God. God has made them godlike because God has a mission for them to carry out in God's name. The Talmud says that we are images of God means we're like God, we're godlike. So how do we become godlike? We imitate, we behave, we walk in God's ways, or imitate God. So here is Soloveitchik's brilliant broadening of this commandment. The Talmud says, what does it mean to imitate God or to be more godlike? As God is merciful, you should be merciful. As God is gracious, giving good without return, so you should be gracious. But here's Soloveitchik's expansion of the idea. It's possible, this is the beginning of this paragraph, it is also possible to point to the matter of honor as an attribute of God. And honor is also an attribute of God, not just mercy. The master of the universe is called King of Glory. Glory itself is often associated with names of God, etc. Therefore, says Soloveitchik, therefore, honor is among the attributes of God. Then also in regard to this attribute, the commandment of walk in his ways, meaning imitate God, become more like God, applies. So just as he is merciful, you too should be merciful. Here's his expansion. Just as he, the king of honor, so you too should be honored, meaning become more honorable, more developed, get more respect. The application of that, if you move to the next text, is that honor is not the only attribute of God. If you look further, you'll see under section 3 that the Bible describes numerous additional capacities of God, which Soloveitchik is hinting, saying, if God has the capacity, you as the human being should walk in God's ways and develop that capacity to be more godlike. Well, what are God's capacities? If you look in the Bible, one is consciousness. God has this omniscient, total, all-embracing consciousness. He reckoned the number of stars. I mean, there are billions and billions of stars. To each he gave its name. The consciousness is so great, it encompasses every star. Great is our Lord and full of power. His wisdom consciousness is beyond reckoning, or if you will, infinite. So to develop our consciousness to understand creation, to understand the world, it is already the most developed among all living things, human consciousness. But to develop it more, whether it be by intellectual development, whether it be by methodological development, science, medicine, to expand our consciousness is to imitate God and to become more godlike. What other examples do we have of God's capacity? Well, power. Amazing power. Think of the power in one lightning, electric in one lightning, or the power of falls, Niagara Falls, the power of nature, the power of the atom, which if it blows apart, unleashes enormous forces. So great is our Lord and full of power. Then the human being who becomes godlike is called to develop the capacity for power, technological achievement, the power to generate energy and electricity. Of course, like God, to use it for life. That's another example, again, where developing the human capacity for power is to become more godlike. Third example, of course, is relationship or love. We are told in the Ashrei, the most frequently said prayer, 3 times a day, the Lord is good to all, and his mercy is upon all his works. Another translation of those words in Hebrew, the Lord is good to all, and his rachamim, his mother love, that's rechem love, rechem is his womb love is upon all his works. God has this infinite capacity to love every human being, to love all of God's creation. And therefore, how, as a human, can I become more godlike? The answer is to develop my capacity for love, my capacity to enter in relationship, my capacity to have compassion and grace and mercy for all those I meet, or as a parent, as a friend, as a teacher, to develop somebody else's capacity, that is to become more godlike. Last but not least, if you move to the fourth quality is freedom. God is by nature, that's the Torah insists, completely free. God cannot be manipulated. God is not bound by routine or by requirements. God, in fact, exercises freedom and freedom of choice. When Moses asked for God's name, he said, "Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I shall be what I shall be." God is unfinished and able to develop and will develop and morph into every possible form. Or again, later, God says, "I will make my goodness before you. I'll proclaim before you God's name, which is the grace that I grant and the compassion that I show." In other words, God chooses to give grace, to give compassion freely. You can't manipulate, you can't buy, you can't force God. That's what magic claims to do. It's false. You can't force God to do the right thing. God is free. And in the human being, imitating God becomes free, develops choice, develops free will, develops the capacity to do good, not under pressure, not under conformity, not under addiction, but under the freedom of choice and of identifying with the cause. In short, and this is the second main point of salvation, that Judaism says we are each called upon to increase the quality of life in the world. The human capacity, which is already highly developed and godlike, can become more godlike, more like God, and this is our calling. So for the scientist who develops the method of science and who develops a telescope that can see into the farthest reach of the universe, or develops a smartphone that can broadcast to the farthest reaches of the planet, this is a way of developing more capacity, more consciousness, and more power of the humans that makes humans more godlike, at least as long as we use it for life. And that is our calling. If we can't, we can do it for ourselves, or we can do it for others. And the final example, if I can, of this commitment to the priority of life is the question is, what if there is a conflict between human life or between individual life and other religious or other obligations or commitments? And here again, the answer of the tradition is life comes first. Although when I would first make the point is that we take this for granted. Today, sort of everybody knows, yeah, Judaism says life overrides Shabbat. You can work on Shabbat and do all the things that are prohibited normally to save a life. We take this for granted, but the truth is this was part of the insight and development of our religion and tradition, that life was first. And I want to give two sources to explore this. The first is a source in Maccabees. The source of Maccabees is very simply this. During the time, which is now Hanukkah, of course, the Hallowed holiday, during the time of the Hasmonean Maccabee revolt against Greek domination, that eventually, after many years of war, led to a temporary, at least several centuries, free, independent Jewish kingdom. During that revolt, there were a number of people in the Maccabee coalition, including Hasidim, the most traditional Jews of those days. Not our Hasidim, but they were called Hasidim too. They were the most traditional Jews. Maccabees tells a story that a group, just as Judah and his brothers and his group, the Hasmonean group, literally revolted. They went to war. They fought the Greeks. The Hasidim, this is what Maccabees tells, went off to the desert because the Greeks had decreed you could not keep Shabbat, you could not keep kosher, you could not practice circumcision. They wanted to obey the tradition, and the Greek king, instigated in part by Jewish assimilating Hellenists, prohibited these acts. So they went off to the desert. And then the Maccabees tells a story. A group of them were hiding on Shabbat. They were surrounded by the Greeks, who told them to come out and surrender and obey the mandate of the king, which is to say, to violate Shabbat and violate the tradition. They refused. But then they said, we're not going to, Greeks said that we're going to come in and kill you. And the Maccabees refused to fight. They said, we will die as martyrs, but we will not violate the Shabbat by doing things like fighting and war that are prohibited on Shabbat. We shall neither come out nor obey the word of the king to profane the Shabbat day. But they said, when they came into them, let us die in our innocence. Heaven and earth bear witness so as that you condemn us unjustly. And they refused to fight. They were killed with their wives, their children, their cattle, the number of 1,000 human beings, because they would not fight on Shabbat. Well, what's going on here? What they were saying was very simply, we are committed to obey the commandments. One of the great commandments is Shabbat. We're prepared to be martyrs. That's why we revolted. We're prepared to die for our beliefs. So we're not going to violate Shabbat in order to save our lives. That was their interpretation. When the Maccabees heard this, the Maccabees said, and this is what the text tells us, if we do as our brothers have done, do not fight for our lives and our laws, they will know quickly wipe us off. They came to, if any man comes against us in battle on Shabbat day, we shall fight against him and not all die as our brothers did. So here is a kind of prudential answer, but the deeper answer is not prudential. The deeper answer is that they understood, But their whole revolt is not just to keep the Torah. It's to keep the religion of life that says life overrides every other commandment, that life is the most precious thing. And therefore, it's a mitzvah to violate Shabbat to save a life. And not just a definite saving, even a doubtful saving. So this is openly articulated in the Talmud, and that's the next text. And again, I don't have the time to read the whole text. The Talmud raises the question, with regard to who suffers pain, can they place medicine in house on Shabbat? And of course, the answer is there's uncertainty, but even uncertainty concerning a life-threatening situation overrides Shabbat. Life is so precious that even if there's a doubtful possibility that they may lose a life, you have to override all commandments and save that life. Then the Talmud says the rabbis were discussing this. The question was asked, from where is it derived that life overrides Shabbat? What's the religious justification? And again, I don't have time, it'd be interesting to go through the next set of, each one gives a different justification. I want to get to the very last paragraph of this text. You can read it for yourself at home. Rabbi Yehuda said, Shmuel, in the name of Shmuel, if I would have been there among those sages who debated this question, I would have said, my proof is the best proof, preferable to yours. What's his proof that Shabbat is overridden? Because it says in the Torah, Leviticus 18, chapter 18, verse 6, you shall keep my statutes and my ordinances, asher yaseh otam ha'adam v'chai b'hem, which a person shall do and live by them. Meaning, he shall live by these mitzvot and not that he should die by them. From which Rabbi Yehuda and Shmuel are telling us that the fundamental idea of the Torah, all the commandments are given to live by. If keeping this commandment will lead you to die by, then you're not to keep that commandment, to override it. So it's a mitzvah to eat on Yom Kippur if the doctor tells you that without eating, your life is at risk. It's a mitzvah to work and do every possible work on Shabbat that can be needed to prepare medicines, to save a life, to operate. Because again, the purpose of the mitzvah is not obedience to God. God said, don't work today. The purpose of the mitzvah is enhancing and saving life. It's interesting, Maimonides, when he summarizes the laws of Shabbat, gives an interesting example. He says, in my time, he knew people who hesitated. If there was not just if it was possible uncertainty that life or death, but even if it was clear cut, that unless they acted, there would be death, they hesitated because they felt, how can I violate Shabbat as such a fundamental commandment, such an important commandment? So they hesitated. And Rambam bitterly criticized them. He said, if they were right, then the Torah's laws are laws that are cruel. They're against life. They're saying, follow God and obey God. And by the way, this was true in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that sect that moved to Qumran to live a purer, more religious life, they thought. In their statutes, it wrote specifically, if someone falls into the water and is drowning on Shabbat, you can't save them. You can't do malacha work on Shabbat to save them. Because they were saying, obedience to Shabbat comes ahead, and it's worth sacrificing your life if necessary. Maimonides says the opposite. They've turned the laws. He said, Maimonides, if they were right that you should not work on Shabbat to save a life, this would be a fulfillment, he said, of a curse. Ezekiel, and the prophet Ezekiel put a curse on the Jewish people. He said, when they misbehave, God said, I will punish you. I will give you chukim lotov. I'll give you no good laws, laws that are no good. Mishpatim, commandments, ashalo yichyu b'hem, which you can't live by. So Maimonides, they're turning the Torah into laws you can't live by, where in order to obey them, you're dying. Absolutely wrong. So to summarize the point, life, even the possibility of saving a life or losing a life, means it's a mitzvah to overrule every commandment in the Torah, because priority of life. There are three for which you have to be prepared to do martyrdom, but maybe in the question and answer we can discuss that. But I conclude with the fundamental point again. Not only are we committed to increase life and improve the quality of life, but we're committed to put life first and to override every other concept. And that would apply to economics, where I can't let money or a lack of health insurance deprive somebody and cause their death, where it comes into COVID, where I don't observe social distancing or masking or avoiding because I'm endangering life. In all these cases, this is prohibited because the ultimate commandment is to choose and uphold life.
Rabbi Greenberg, I'm just going to start because I don't want to waste any moment of being able to be in conversation with you, especially around your ideas that I feel like have animated a lot of my rabbinate, but I've never been able to articulate as beautifully as you have, and with the source power behind it. I want to offer one quick reflection, and then I have an area of conversation or a question in each of your three areas: increasing quantity, increasing quality, and then pikuach nefesh, or life overriding all other concerns, or almost all other concerns. All right, so the first observation I want to make, and you and I had a little bit of a chance to talk about this already, is as you were laying out your hypothesis both last week with Rabbi Holzblatt and this week, and I know it's coming next week, what came to my mind immediately was the seven blessings, the Sheva Brachot, that are said both at a Jewish wedding and then afterwards for a period of time in order to sort of uplift the couple. And it's almost striking how similar they are. It's as if the authors had a chance to learn with you a couple thousand years ago. And number one, Shehakol bara lichvodo, that everything was created for God's honor, glory, kavod. There's that word, that creation is in fact pointed towards kavod, that God is Yotzer HaAdam, a fashioner of humanity. And then the fourth blessing is that fashioning of humanity actually has a purpose. It's v'hitkin lo mimenu binyan adayad. It's to perpetuate eternity through being godlike, which means bringing more people into the world, which then leads to the redemptive blessing of Tzion, of people of the ingathering, and ends up in God Eden, which goes back to where you left off last week of order before the seventh blessing, which is the emotional array of, you know, happiness, joy, peace, harmony. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you think the rabbis were onto something when they imagined that moment in which two people might be standing, whatever the chuppah may have been in antiquity, standing there listening to these blessings as a directive for what their lives ought to be like together.
Well, it's a wonderful observation. It's a wonderful observation. I love it. And of course, the answer, they didn't study with me. The answer is I studied with them. Me, having studied those sources, and I and the rabbis studying the Torah in the first place, have come pointed to this, and you're absolutely right. They become an image of God when I've established a relationship. I've come to know them better. And eventually what happens, I come to love this person. Now, if I come to love this person, they become literally infinitely valued. No amount of money can replace. When I come to love them, they become equal. It doesn't matter if I'm stronger or richer or more famous or more powerful. If I truly love them, it's irrelevant. Then I love them and I need them, and they are equal to me. And in fact, if I know if I don't treat them equally, I can lose their love. And you need me the same way. If I love somebody, they're irreplaceable. If not, they're not. So what you have pointed out to not only is that this is the key to establishing a good marriage, but that in fact, a good marriage or a relationship of love, a relationship of commitment, committed love, and of mutual responsibility, is one of the key ways to discover the image of God and the true value of the human person. Well, I think that is, of course, that's our challenge. We're so happy and celebrate at the wedding because, at least for the moment, as you all know, no guarantees, but at least for the moment, that's the joy and the celebration and setting. Lesson here, love works. Love committed, love works, and we have a feeling flowering of the image of God in these people.
That's beautiful. Thank you. All right, so I'm going to complicate this piece now. I have two questions for you around the increasing of the quantity of human life. The first question is, in Richard Elliot Friedman's commentary on the Torah, he has his shortest commentary in the entire book is on be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He says, this commandment has now been fulfilled, period. And so I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit on where we are with Pru or Vu, and also to think about the earth and what it means to fill the earth and what the Torah may have intended there. And the second question, I would love for you to hone in a little bit on how to fulfill Pru or Vu when, or for those who have been created in such a way that fulfilling it in the way our ancestors understood it is impossible, which is to say, how expansive is this commandment? What do we do with infertility? What do we do? I mean, there are so many ways in which we could read this in such a local way that it would be impossible to fulfill. And I'm not sure that's what the Torah has in mind. I'm curious to know what you think about both of those.
We have now reached the point where increase in life can endanger the quality of life. And the answer is the mitzvah is to fill the world with life in its full dignity. In fact, the whole Tikkun Olam is about increasing and improving the world to sustain life. If increasing life is going to take away the dignity, you're not increasing life. And therefore, the answer is it should be practiced responsibly now in terms of the capacity of the resources to support it, in terms of the capacity of people to support it. I say responsibly for two reasons. First of all, because to stop having children altogether, well, bluntly, we have the problem now, seriously, Social Security. In other words, at some point, not just in America, all over the world, if the previous generation is living longer and there aren't enough people working to replace them, then the society can't support these people. So there is a need for ongoing life and creativity, but it has to be responsible. We have to do a much better job of controlling pollution and restricting industry to not violate the environment, et cetera, et cetera. But within that framework, there is room for the mitzvah. And again, I would argue that the Jewish people. And for those people, and I would include not just the Jews, I mean, the Tibetans, I could give you a long list of people who have been destroyed or oppressed or as victims of genocide. I think they have a legitimate right to have larger families to be able to restore their own people, their own dignity. But we have to do it responsibly. And that's your question. I couldn't agree more on that. And that brings me to your second question, which I have now forgotten. Your second question was?
How to fulfill the mitzvah of Pru or Vu.
For people who can't fulfill it. Very important point. One of the greatness of our time, I really believe that, is that many times the perfectionist and the ideal visions of Judaism tend to, at least in the tradition, tend to ignore the people who can't live up to that ideal, that tradition. And there's a danger that you are glorifying one side at the expense of your self-respect and dignity of others. So to glorify having children, which I stand behind, I think it's one of the great human activities and creativity. But what about a person who doesn't have that ability? So the answer very simply is, according to Jewish tradition, you have A, the choice of adoption, that is, take care of a child who otherwise could not be taken care of, or B, intellectually, spiritually, humanly, emotionally develop a child. That's the equivalent. For example, the tradition says that a teacher who shapes me spiritually, who shapes me ethically and emotionally, should be treated like a parent. So my answer is, if people do not have the physical capacity, or again, for reasonable judgments, they can't take it on financially or emotionally, the answer is, but you do have the option to use your life, your capacity, to enhance or to make possible life for someone else. And that's indeed foster children. I mean, there are all kinds of examples. So that's a very important observation in both ways, that people who can't have a child literally should not feel degraded or inadequate. The answer is they don't have that capacity, but they have an equivalent capacity that they can use, because that capacity is to create, but also to enhance and develop life for them.
It actually takes the obligation of Shinantan Levanecha, of teaching our children, and places it sort of squarely within the obligation of Pru or Vu, to increase and multiply. And then it blends in, which is sort of moving into the next area, it blends into the quality of life question, or the capacities that make us more godlike. The one I actually would like you to focus on is the one I think that is hardest for human beings, especially the Jewish community, to understand. And it's chen, or chesed. And I'm going to let you get into chen or chesed. Grace, or compassion, which when we talked, you explained it as womb-like. I'm not sure you use that phrase today, but I'm going to throw it back in there so you can go back to it. And it's Parshat Ki Tisa, in which God's ultimate chesed, or chen, comes upon the Israelite people who God would prefer to destroy until a human being convinces God that there's chesed in God. Forgiveness without tshuva, forgiveness for the sake of one's humanity or for the sake of one's divinity. These are hard concepts for Jews because we feel like, you know, other people have a claim on them, even though they appear, it seems, first in Torah. So just go with that.
You know, my answer is the more the merrier. Knows that. First of all, that, let me put it this way. You really said two things, and they're very both important. One is that it's not a one-way street that God reveals it all and we just accept it. But one of the great, really important teachings of Judaism and of the Jewish religion about Greek covenant, it's a partnership. And in this partnership, not only we are supposed to grow and develop, but God grows and develops. Or at least our understanding of God grows and develops. And yes, it was the Jewish tradition that took, at least in the Bible, God's first definition says, I am forgiving, I'm merciful. God's mercy and grace, unjustified, giving away of goodness without anything in return. It's for thousands of generations. But then he turns around and says, but for the first two, three, or four generations, I will punish, I will not forgive totally. So it's possible the children will be punished for the sin of their parents. The rabbis came to argue and understand. Starting with Moshe, who argued with God not to wipe out the Jewish people. But the real implication of love and of covenant is really unconditional. Even if I do badly, even if I act wrongly and hurt your feelings completely, even if I do the ultimate sin of idolatry, out of committed love, you should be ready to understand and forgive, accept my limitations, maybe to punish, maybe I have to repent, but you don't simply wipe me out. That is the message of covenant. So we, in a sense, fed back to God, if you're going to be loving and forgiving to thousands of generations, that's a ratio of 500 to 1 before punishing. It's not a good enough ratio. From you, we expect an infinite ratio, unconditional love, forgiving even before generations. And that's indeed how the rabbis, that's our contribution. We're carrying on their tradition that to improve the full implications of love in many areas. The Torah is full of cases of capital punishment. The rabbis said the logic of infinite value, the logic of the uniqueness of the Tzelem Elokim, is that even a criminal, even a murderer, should not be put to death. And the rabbis basically all but abolished. They made it extremely, extremely rare, capital punishment. And yes, that's the logic of Jewish tradition, to altogether take away capital punishment. Because in the way, even if the authorities do it, and even if he deserved it, it weakens the reverence for God. We want to make the respect for life absolute and unconditional. So you made a very important, and you're modest, you didn't give the credit to the rabbis to yourself, which they deserve. The answer is that we have improved and developed a deeper understanding of God. Now, many Jews feel, or at least some of the Christian teachings and other religions, for example, forgive your enemies or turn the other cheek or give forgiveness even if he hasn't repented. Many people feel, I'm one of them, but that's going too far. In the end, when Pope John Paul said to his would-be assassin, I forgive you, I think he was wrong because the assassin had not apologized, had not reflected, had not repented. And I think the danger becomes when you forgive unqualifiedly, particularly evil people, instead of taking it and changing their lives, which would be wonderful if it worked. They take this as a kind of an appeasement and justifying to go on. So the truth is that, we learned the bitter lesson in the Holocaust, that the Hitlers of this world do not stop when you make an appeal. I mean, Gandhi wrote it, who I admired, and the whole idea of nonviolence and civil disobedience should not be violent. I honor that. But he then made the foolish application. If the Jews in Germany would not have resisted Hitler, they should have voluntarily gone along with everything, they would change. The answer is they wouldn't have changed. I mean, in fact, Hitler rounded them up and the other Jews and killed them. So he could only be stopped and was stopped by force. So the answer is it's a balance. Nevertheless, having said that, I think there's a very important insight in the teaching that God forgives even the criminal, or that God forgives and gives grace even if people didn't earn it. And I think Jews mistakenly think, well, if the Christians say that, we have to say the opposite. Not so. In fact, Shai Held is writing a book about this, but the whole idea of God is love and God is loving and God is forgiving is a central idea in Judaism. And somehow it, over the course of the centuries, because the Christians stressed it and because they had a stereotype that the rabbis or the Bible is God of wrath, so Jews said, well, if you believe in love, we're against love. We're not. So we have to, in general, learn not to say whatever they say, we are different. There are some things which are shared, and some things, where we, frankly, we can learn from them. That's one of the blessings of living in this century, in this period, that you can learn from Christianity, not just fight it, or disagree with it, but learn from it. And I think that those down the board, they have the blessing of learning for us. I want to make one other comment, because you're talking about they're not comparing, but I want to say one more thing. Again, unfortunately, Jews have not done as much for social action as Christians did initially in America. Within the Jewish tradition, the more traditional groups did less. And I think the restoration of social action and the responsibility for human beings as a primary, it is primary in the Bible, is a tremendous contribution. And it's something that the Orthodox or the traditional Jews should learn from. And I think your contribution, because what are you doing when you're increasing social action? What you're saying is that every human being should be treated as an image of God. They should be treated as equal, and they should be given justice equally, and they should be given access to wealth and to achievement and to dignity and to education equally. Well, that's what it's all about. This is a true fulfillment, and we should worry less whether we're saying the same or different than other religions. On the contrary, what we should do is listen to them when they're doing something better than us, and make ourselves better. But in this case, as we're making ourselves better, what is, I think, a hard tradition. So my hat is off to you or on to you, Rabbi Alexander, for that contribution. I think it's a very important emphasis that has to be restored to our tradition.
I mean, I love the way that you sort of navigate between that space of grace and accountability, which you just did very well, which is to say, we can actually hold both of those things at once. And in fact, if one of the things we are meant to be is B'Tselem Elohim, God-like in many ways, imperfection, the capacity to make mistakes, the capacity to become ever-becoming proves it. Because even as God was ever-forgiving with the Israelites at the foot of the mountain, God was not so forgiving with Korach, which is to say it's like there's no like straight road to grace or accountability. There's trying to navigate the difference, and maybe God can do kapara, atonement, but we can't be fully God. We can only be God-like and step somewhere into that messiness in our lives. And I feel like that's one of the hardest for many of us to deal with is, or to live, which is forgiveness in moments in which we're just so frustrated or angry.
We need role models like you, frankly, really. And to me, that's what really Rabbis is about. Of course, teaching and leading and so on is wonderful, but the most valuable thing is the role model, the example, including struggling with the messiness and making mistakes and getting better. And you're offered a wonderful role model, and I think we all can learn from each other.
Thank you. One question that came in: should we think of Chen and Rachamim differently? Grace and mercy, and is there a difference between the two?
I'm not sure, because I think in the end, love or unconditional love particularly implies all the above. In other words, love, if you love somebody, you forgive them, certainly forgive them for cause, and they repent, and then they try to do better. But I would say when you love somebody, it doesn't stop. It's not a finite quantity that I give out. And I think as it goes on, one tends to extend it even more. And that includes grace. We're just giving goodness because I love this person so much. I'm happy to give them good whether or not they earned it, whether or not they gave me something in return. I think so. So they're not identical behaviors. They're separate. But I think in the end, one should lead to the other. And one should not be bound just to stay within one category. Would you, again, at some condition that we do what you just said, which is, I mean, wonderful. balance of accountability and grace. Grace, totally one-sided grace without accountability runs the risk of rewarding and encouraging the judgment. But balance, yes, I think it should go.
Now we are going to complicate the Pikuach Nefesh piece. Those questions are coming in. There's a question about abortion. And so enhancing the quantity of life and enhancing the quality of life seem to be in tension. And I would say, what happens when the definition of life for different peoples is in tension and decisions have to be made about quality and quantity?
Very well taken, by the way. And you already hinted at the question that you get, what I think is the proper answer. Just like with the quantity question where Rabbi Alexander raised, at the end, the number has reached a point where there's a direct tension and conflict even between quantity and quality. And my answer again is that quality of life is no less important and it has to be protected. So simply increasing quantity with no respect for or degradation of quality is, I believe, mistaken and wrong. So that's the whole, that's the same issue with abortion. I think that literally, what I mean by that is that the so-called anti-abortion is pro-life. I disagree. The issue involved in abortion is the tension of quantity and quality. If I, in fact, have this child, either because the child will be so handicapped or flawed, and I can't handle it, or it will have an impossible life, or maybe a life that will be cut short in the most cruel and vicious way by the Tay-Sachs or whatever disease that I'm talking about. It's a tension. In that case, do I have the right to terminate the fetus? Or in a much subtler and maybe less clearly defined case, what if I feel the child, I am not up to it, or I can't handle it? And what is it? My answer, it's like birth control. My answer is the choice to regulate birth, or whether having children turn birth control or terminating by abortion a fetus, it's the same issue. It's a legitimate, it's pro-life, it's pro-quality of life. In this case, the abortion. Now again, when abortion becomes casual, it will cheapen the value of life. When abortion becomes, as it became in Russia, and it's the bizarre, Stalinist Puritanism, that they were hostile to birth control. So they ended up in the end that women didn't have birth control, but then had lots of abortion. So it's vicious. I mean, so you're turning, that I think is wrong. Now again, maybe I'm lucky, the Jewish tradition does not consider the fetus full life and therefore have the full dignity of life, because when it has the full dignity of life, you can't terminate it. But I say this in part because I disagree with, let's say, Catholic or many evangelical Christian position that abortion is absolutely prohibited. But I appreciate the fact that it's growing out of their, at least their theological emphasis on that even the fetus is the soul, and therefore you can't. The Jewish answer, and thank God for that, is not that the fetus life comes after the mother's life comes first, and one may abort to save the mother's life. So I certainly, that gives us the margin not only to abort to save the mother's life, but to abort for other situations which are not quite fully saving life, but are partial, which involve the old examples I gave. The quality of life is not right or can't be handled by the parents. I think these are legitimate pro-life choices. And again, I'm not arguing. I will say one last thing. I think in our society, there is this danger of abortion becoming casual. There is a danger of abortion becoming, I think, mistaken. Why do I say it's dangerous? Because it is a more serious prevention of life than birth control. Therefore, it affects my attitude, respectful for life, just as capital punishment. It does, the rabbis concluded, does affect my respect for life, even though I'm punishing deservedly so. The rabbi said, no, the very fact that a life has been put together weakens the awesomeness and the reverence for life. So don't do it, or do it as little as possible. That's my position on the book. Not as little as possible, but it's legitimate choice the quality of life, and one should never in any way defer or give away the idea that somehow I'm cheapening life just by abortion itself. Unless abortion becomes a form of cheapening of life, then it's a very legitimate mitzvah, a very legitimate practice of upholding the quality and reverence for life.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, or one way to frame this would be that the quality of life, which is subjective in nature, can in fact override the obligation to the quantity of life, even though it is objective. And that is actually quite remarkable, if that's what you're saying, if I got that right, based on what you have been saying. Remarkable in that it goes against, or it's counterintuitive to how most of us think about our subjective understanding of our lives influencing objective reality. Or the Torah, which is an object, it looks to be, or some considered an objective document. And so that leads into the question that's been asked by a few people now, which is another tension. How do we understand quality of life when it comes to our spiritual and religious norms, such that was Haman correct, in fact, to put his life in danger? This is my interpretation of this. I think the question that was asked was about the Greek edicts. Who gets to determine when the religious quality of my life is so diminished that I'm willing to risk the objective physical life for the spiritual life that I couldn't actually get to because of it? So that's why the Haman, like, who's right in that situation?
It's a fair question. And, you know, by the way, Maimonides, in the Middle Ages, when the Crusades, and they forced the Jews, they say, we're going to convert your children. And unless they'll kill you and convert your children. And they killed their children rather than let them be forcibly converted, or they themselves were martyred. This actually went against halakha. And interesting enough, Maimonides, who was not in the Crusades and not under Christianity, nevertheless, he wrote that someone who martyrs to uphold a religion unnecessarily, meaning they could have, as he felt that they could have faked it, they could have done a kind of a conformist conversion just to survive, and then they could have gone back to their way. I guess that's what was done, well, at least according to some scholars, this was done by Maimonides' family, that they faked it and then they went to another country and they resumed their Jewishness. Be that as it may, he says that that's suicide, whereas he condemns it. He said, in other words, the commitment to uphold life is so great that they should have really not given the martyrdom, they should have chosen to stay alive and figure out an alternate way of going back. Now, this will give me an excuse to respond to what Rabbi Alexander wanted me to do, to the three cases in which martyrdom is called for in Jewish tradition. My argument is, it's all about life. And the three exceptions are not overridden because the rabbis felt that in these three cases, if you violate them in order to save a life, you're going to undermine the respect and the quality and reverence for life, and therefore you will have ended up death to win, and that's wrong. What do I mean by that? The obvious case, the first case is the case of murder. They say to me, either you kill this innocent person or I'll kill you. What do I do if I kill the innocent person? I'm weakening respect for the whole awe and reverence for treating the value of life. If, on the other hand, I say, no, kill me, if they kill me, in each case, only one life has died. But in this case, killing me, I'm upholding the awe and reverence for life. But people say, life is so precious that it's worth letting them kill you rather than giving in. So that's the point. So in this case, you're not to surrender, because if you surrender and you allow death, you're cheapening murder, you're cheapening and weakening the reverence for life. Second case, idolatry. And this is a much broader issue. I wish I could do justice, but I'll say it in 30 seconds. I believe the rabbis saw that idolatry is the counter to true religion. Why? True religion, and Judaism is their model, is all about life and upholding life. Here's my personal free theory. God is infinite. Only an infinite God can sustain the infinite value of every human life. Now, what happens to idolatry? You take a human, whether it's a human being like a Hitler or a Stalin, or you take a human artifact, communism, or any philosophy, jihad, you can take Islam and say, this is absolute, and for this absolute, I will kill. This is a false absolute. It's a human absolute, and it's not infinite. So it's a pseudo-infinite. Now, how can a pseudo-infinite sustain life? The answer is an infinite God can sustain infinite value, but a one person can't. So you know how they do it? How can they be God by being infinite? The answer is if I'm one, Hitler's one, I make you a zero. One is infinitely more than zero. If I want to be God, I have to make human beings to zero. That's what idolatry does. So the rabbis felt if idolatry wins, it'll not just be an individual case. All of life will be undermined. If you absolutize any human system, capitalism, I don't know what it is, millions will die because they will be sacrificed. And therefore the rabbis felt in this case, die so that your death will resist and testify against this, that life is worth more. And this is not absolute. This is finite. This is false. As for Gilui Arayot, for the forbidden sexual relations, again, I'll take the easy case, the case of incest or rape. The answer is the rabbis felt this is the equivalent of murder. Because rape, or for that matter, incest, you're really not just a one-time event. You're really destroying the soul, the self-respect, the dignity, the sense of security and inner value. And therefore, again, it's the equivalent of murder. And again, rather than give in to murder, which weakens respect for life, you have to give your life. So that would be my interpretation, and that would be also how I'd apply it to the question itself.
I hope that's going to be in the book. That is the best explanation of those three exceptions that I have heard by a long shot of how we are to understand them, and really pushes forward that idea that life is tied to quality of life, and I think can help us inform a lot of our end-of-life conversations as well, outside of, you know, the tense moments, but just end of life questions in general.
I think this whole tension of quality of life, I want to point that in the creation story. And last week I point this out. There are three basic rhythms in creation. There is the movement from chaos to order, which the whole point of order is that it sustains life and enables life. Without order, life cannot be sustained. Secondly, there's the quantity of life from non-life to life. But no less important is the movement from less capacity, less quality to higher quality. So these are part of the rhythm. So there is a tension. But again, it's very clear in the tradition and in this creation story that in the end, God's goal is not merely numbers, but quality. And therefore, the fact that the human evolved into a higher, more developed form, God wants that, that God wants in general. As I said last week, I don't think we're the final word either. The maximum of life becomes more and more like God. So I think that's what I want to stress here too. It's not just that there's a tension in that quality of life should win. Never you mind the claim that this is objective, whereas quality of life is subjective. Number one is in the end, I think all human judgments are subjective, but I think we have to take that responsibility. That's again like God. We take responsibility. That's, again, one of the great Jewish teachings of our time. We'll talk about it a little bit next week. Humans have taken full responsibility for the applying the law. And yes, it brings with it subjectivity and distortion. And that's why I keep saying we need pluralism and multiple views to protect us against one-sided distortion. Nevertheless, in the end, that's what God wants, to take the risk of the distortion, but to uphold the most precious judgment, which is quality of life. It may be subjective, but it's precious, and it's the ultimate hope and goal that life not only exist and flourish, but it grow and develop even more godlike. So that's part of our contribution.
Our producers for this episode are Sam Greenberg, Jeremy Tabak, and Susan Pilewski. Thank you to Nadav Remez for editing this episode. Additional editing by David Chavinsky. I'm your host, Rabbi Avi Killip. It's been a pleasure to learn with you.